In Uyirvu, Oisin is kind of thinking through the ways in which they can resist or illustrate the histories of resistance and futures that are kind of filled with regenerative joy. Some of the Tamil texts, particularly the word Amaidi, which you can see in one of the panels, it kind of evokes a sense of serenity, tranquility, and harmony. It's also a word that kind of signals to somebody who might share similar heritage and the Tamil language to kind of pause and recognize that this moment of this panel being here in the city is not really an accident, it is by design and it is for those communities. There are other typographic symbols that Oisin presents across the panels, one of them being Mahavira, which is right above the tiger, which translates to warriors, and Otrumai, which accompanies the three-headed snake, which kind of translates to togetherness. And in conjunction with the character holding the lizard, those works also kind of reference the history of symbiotic relationships between man, animal, and other non-human beings. And to think through what are the ways to imagine joy as a sort of multidimensional experience as we go around the clock tower, and you kind of see that the figure holding the lizard is also kind of donning a kind of space helmet, which kind of signals this journey from the resistance that's built into the Dalit communities and marginalized caste communities of South Asia as a political movement, all the way to kind of personal imagination and speculation of what futures we can kind of wish for ourselves.
That's great. And it's like having that on the outward sort of facing sense, so it's the first thing you're experiencing as you enter Otalala. There's something about that as well, having that. It's great. Okay, we're now going to move into the foyer. And to our left, opposite the reception desk or the box office, is a large LCD screen playing a video work called Listening to the Mouth of a River by Yasira Musa, who is from South Africa and currently living in Naam, Melbourne. Listening to the Mouth of a River is a four-minute piece where the Kiwa Hydro Scheme, a power plant that's embedded within and distributed across Victoria's high country. So it's surveyed by sound, and there are headphones in front of the screen to listen to the accompanying soundtrack. As we're here at the moment on the screen, there's river water flowing with green vegetation on either side. There are large rocks and stones. There's a wider shot of what looks like a lake with water, rain falling onto the water and dappling the water as it goes down. Vishal, can you talk more about this work?
Yes, absolutely. So Yasira is an artist whose family comes from the western state of Gujarat in India, but migrated and lived in South Africa and now relocated to Australia. So Yasira's kind of point of entry into thinking about the kind of structures, infrastructures within the work that she's presenting starts from kind of her own personal journey of moving across these different, essentially colonial enterprises and becoming enmeshed in those colonial systems as a person living through those different environments. Within the work itself, Yasira is kind of interrogating the infrastructure and the mechanisms of extraction of colonial enterprise, particularly in this case, the Kiewa Hydro Scheme, which is tapping the river to generate electricity in rural Victoria, but also for other towns and cities across Victoria. Kiewa is in itself in proximity to the Australian Alpine region in the Victorian Alps, as I understand the kind of landscape of rural Victoria around where the hydro scheme itself is. But it's kind of nestled into the landscape as if it is a benign object or a benign structure that doesn't seem to really have any sort of industrial purpose, when in fact it is performing great acts of extraction upon country and upon lands that traditionally do not belong to the powers that actually built this infrastructure. So in Listening to the Mouth of a River, Yasira is kind of thinking about these mechanisms of extraction through the infrastructures that were built within natural landscape as a way of considering them as a monument of colonial time, of the time within the context of Australia, as a kind of symbol that also has larger kind of connotations to colonial mechanisms elsewhere, but particularly here in the context of Australia as being somebody who's engaging with it from the role of an architect or in the time that the work was made as an architecture student, thinking through what is the kind of built environment that you're really contributing to? What is the kind of built environment that you're imagining within your role as a student, but also what are the kind of infrastructures that already dictate how some of this imagination actually occurs? And in the work, Yasira is very clearly kind of trying to circumvent the image object or preoccupations of maps and monuments, which, as we understand, was a very inherently colonial endeavor, and kind of uses sound as the mechanism to survey something that is impossible to kind of capture, which is the spiritual, seasonal, and subjective kind of limitations to representing place. So across the 3 minutes or so of the video, Yasira's film also kind of takes sound from the location itself and kind of plays it back as if it is a kind of artifact of a time that seemingly has ended, but infrastructures and the mechanisms of extraction continue.
Yeah, that's great. And again, there are headphones placed in the front of the LCD monitor. They're over-the-head headphones, so you can listen to the soundtrack that accompanies the work. Okay, so we're going to basically turn around. And so to the left of the box office or reception area is the beginning of a grand stairway that curves up to the right and then continues up to the next level. And on the stairwell walls are six artworks, Queer on Country by Peter Waples-Crow, who is from Narigo, whose art practice explores the intersection of an Indigenous queer identity, spirituality, and Australia's ongoing colonisation. Queer on Country works are multi-layered compositions infused with symbolism, narrative, and visual language that investigates the representation of First Nations people in popular culture. So each square measures 1.2 metres by 1.2 metres and uses a combination of paint and collage on wood panel. And I think you mentioned, Vishal, that the original works are smaller, is that correct?
Yeah.
15 centimetres by 15. And they were blown up specifically.
They were blown up originally as part of Midsummer Festival last year and kind of placed outside as public art during the festival. And we're kind of now presenting them within the context of another kind of publicly accessible community space, which is Arts House.
And I'll describe how it's laid out and the artworks themselves. So from the base of the stairs, there are three that are hung vertically, one on top of the other, on the left wall. And perpendicular to that, on the wall ahead, two again hung, one on top of the other. And then halfway up the stairs, opposite to the first three, is a single piece hanging. Each piece has a large charcoal black icon overlaying the collaged and painted scene beneath. The background is on each work is typically in two sections, and they are the horizon and the earth or the ground below. From the top down, the first has a thick black painted cross. In the background, the top half is red with repeating black curved lines. Below that, in the bottom half, a collage of black and white semicircle-shaped paper cutouts. The second piece features three concentric black painted circles against a background of blue on the lower half, with repeating black curved lines and a collage of red and white old birthday cards that have been torn and reassembled, where the words of happy birthday, a face, a clown hat are partially visible. The third piece has a black dingo with its four paws looking as though they're aflame, painted in licks of yellow and orange flame against a brown earth and a collage sky of dark and slate grey pieces of paper with a scattering of printed stenciled flowers on either a red or black background. The next two pieces on the adjacent wall, the top one features what appears to be a large black pair of lungs, or another way of seeing this could be that they are wings. They're in that shape. The top section is a red background with a repeating pattern of three black squares, one inside the other. The bottom section, a collage of cut-out pages of drawings and illustrations layered with blue pieces of paper. The one below this features a hunting stick upon a horizon, haphazardly collaged with red large capital letters. Some of the letters are W, Y, S, G, and O. above a green painted background with repeating horizontal black lines. And finally, the piece hanging halfway up the stairs features the emu painted black and central. The upper half in the background is painted grey with a pattern of black concentric circles and randomly placed painted small orange flowers. What can you tell me about Peter's works?
Peter's works, these six panels, are part of a body of work called Queer on Country that explores Peter's indigenous queer spirituality. Both the painted and the collaged kind of panels, or like the parts of the panel, they suggest a tension between the kind of dual landscapes of identity today, which is Peter's own Aboriginal heritage, but also the kind of cultural landscape of possessing a Western identity. And that tension is referencing the larger tensions between Aboriginal culture and Western culture, as well as the ongoing colonization of country. The kind of symbols in the works themselves that are painted over in black, they reference Peter's personal symbols and totemic expressions of his own Narigo identity. And the works are speaking directly to both the lack and the need for visibility, as well as pride in belonging to Aboriginal queer mob. Peter's works are kind of hung opposite Yasira's work, also as a reference to the landscape that surrounds these conversations, being Victorian High Country, which is also the region in proximity to what is traditionally Narigo Country, where Peter comes from. It's also to kind of suggest that borders of country and borders of regions across current-day Australia are a lot newer. They're kind of shaped by mechanisms of power and access and infrastructure, mechanisms that have a lasting impact, whether those that impact is in the recent history of Australia, but also in histories of migration, and what kind of place it provides for somebody coming into this context and onto the continent of Australia to kind of engage with. Like, essentially, it is a way of suggesting that a personal exploration of finding or seeking belonging in the context of Australia, in the case of Yasira's work, is also reflected in Peter's work in seeking belonging, as well as the shared experience of being diaspora, whether it's diasporic within the continent of the new construct of Australia as a continent, but traveling between countries, coming from Narigo country, coming into traditional lands that Nam kind of belongs to, as well as moving in a kind of diasporic existence across Western India to South Africa to Australia. So the works are very much in conversation across time and space, but they're also highlighting the shared quest for finding themselves and finding themselves represented in a way that they would like to be represented and they would like to be seen.
Excellent. Thanks, Vishal. So that finishes the foyer area. So we're now entering the main hall, which has a polished dark hardwood sprung floor, and it is about 25 metres in length and 13 metres wide. It's currently darkly lit except for the works illuminated in the space. The hall has been divided into three sections using black heavy theatre curtains. In this middle section, where we are now, are four works. And then in the small area at back on our left is one work. And on the opposite side, at the other end of the hall, is one work. We will move through the exhibition in a clockwise direction. So, immediately inside the entrance to our left is a stark white room with a wide doorway for audience to view from, but not to enter. In the centre of the room is a small wooden stepladder, approximately a metre high. There's a red garment or uniform or overalls draped over the top of the step and that hangs halfway down the ladder. Called Caste Pittle, this is the space where artist Sajan Mani will hold their durational performance. Vishal, can you tell us about this work?
Sure. We're presenting two works here by Sajan Mani, who comes from Kerala but is based in Berlin. Sajan has two works in here, Caspital being the first of them. And in Caspital, Sajan is performing a kind of durational work over several days, as well as marking a kind of midway point or a pause moment on the 20th of April at 12 p.m. Sajan works across a range of material practices as well as performance and media-based practices. But within Caste Patil, Sajan is specifically thinking about the poetry of the revolutionary poet Poikail Appachan, who's a poet from the state of Kerala, whose works weren't really written down but have been carried over as oral history from generation to generation. Poikail, as a young man, was adopted into a family that was practicing caste slavery. But Poikail worked in that kind of enslaver's field from a very young age. And certain events that happen in that space, in those fields, kind of spur Poikail to start singing. And he's singing these kind of songs of pain, of grief, but also songs of kind of lamenting for presence, for recognition of his own existence within the context of Kerala at that time. Sajan is kind of drawing from those songs and performing them as an act of writing in Malayalam across the whole space that we've earmarked here. Unfolding over multiple days, Sajan will fill up the whole room with drawings of Malayalam letters, as well as words coming from Poikail's poetry. Sajan uses a range of kind of objects within the performance, which are kind of also determined when he actually comes here and enters the space, because each performance is different from the other, also referencing the lands that the performance is being performed, like conducted on, and recognizing that hailing from a family of rubber tappers in Kerala who are kind of indigenous to the lands that he comes from, paying his respect and paying his to kind of be respectful of the lands that he's entering as a visitor. So the performance that will unfold here, starting in about 10 days or so, and continues on beyond the day of the moment of pause, is essentially kind of trying to bring in the context of the land that he's on and continuing with his own exploration of history and Poikail's songs drawn across the space.
Beautiful. And then so we have another, just sort of moving down into the space, we have another work by Sajan, and it is, the title of this work is Stretched Light and Muted Howls, and has been created on acrylic and serigraphs on natural rubber sheet. The piece is about 1.8 metres high and 1 metre wide, and it's made up of 9 tan-coloured rubber mats that have been stitched together. It's a grid of eyes, 3 pairs per sheet, so altogether there's 27 pairs of eyes that have been printed from archival photos in white paint, all staring straight ahead. And although this work is not tactile, you are more than welcome to approach it to smell the scent or sense of the latex material. Vishal, sort of expanding on the previous work, what can you tell us about?
So this section of the hall itself on the left-hand side when you enter contains 3 works. There's Sajan's performance, there's Sajan's work Stretched Light and Muted Howls, which is the work we're talking about, and towards the end is Priyagita Dia's Lament Heat, which we will go into in a little while. But Stretched Light and Muted Howls is presented in the center point between the two works, referencing the histories of rubber plantations that both works are kind of talking about. Particularly here, Sajan is referencing the material itself as hailing from a community of rubber tappers, of communities that perform the extraction of rubber sap from the rubber trees, as something that was started by colonial enterprise. It also is a continuation of caste slavery, which Sajan is talking about in Caste Patil, because rubber tapping is very much a caste occupation. It is performed by certain communities, also as it's a very highly toxic practice, but also kind of is deemed impure as an act of impurity in order to extract rubber, which kind of goes into the larger conversations about caste being a system of laboring bodies and not of a system of labor. In the work itself, the eyes that we see, a kind of collage of many different eyes, are cropped versions of images taken by colonial sort of photographers and within the colonial machinery across South Asia, but particularly in the state of Kerala by German missionaries, as well as these images themselves being held in German libraries and archives and state museums. The photographs themselves were taken to chronicle the lived experience of Dalit and indigenous communities in Kerala, but they kind of are presented in this colonial racist gaze, kind of talking about the kind of colonial regime of photography and drawing those connections with how Aboriginal and First Nations communities were also photographed in the context of Australia. Particularly in this case, Sajan within the work is presenting this complex history of missionaries, particularly in this case, the German missionaries, were the first to translate and create standardized Malayalam and publish several books in Malayalam, which is the case across South India and across South Asia as well, where colonial mechanisms of literacy allowed for the emancipation of marginalized caste communities. But that did not kind of offset the caste slavery and the practices of how laboring bodies were organized. So he's kind of presenting this juxtaposition of the fact that conversion to Christianity and conversion by missionaries from different colonial powers allowed for access to education or access to a promise of emancipation. But those very people who were trying to seek out this emancipation were then still represented as nameless kind of bodies within the archives that the colonial powers were forming. So he's presenting them within this form of 9 hand-woven latex panels, each of them containing 3 sets of eyes, starting from the top to the bottom, which themselves are kind of drawn from different colonial archives currently held in Germany. And with the work, Sajan is essentially trying to bring, kind of unfreeze the time of the time that these photographs were made and reinstate the inherent dignity of the bodies and the people that were being photographed at the time.
Thank you. So we are moving into the space, and this is the work that is off to the left and down the back. And we're moving into a small curtained off area. And as you enter the space, a screen hangs, taking up basically the whole of one wall, and it's quite overwhelming in size. The work is a video work by Priya Geetha Dia, and the name of the work is Lament, H-E-A-T, and that's currently playing at the moment. It's an ongoing research project that asks, can memories of subjugation in Malaya's colonial past be reconciled with through rituals of listening mediated by technology? And can contemporary art hosted within the museum become that remarkable place for reconciliation? And at the moment on the screen, there are tall trees with green shrubbery underneath. The branches of the trees are thin and narrow, with foliage up the top, and the air is moving slowly between the leaves and the trees, just shifting the smaller branches subtly. And the camera is panning gently across from right to left, and you can hear the soundtrack playing in the background. Vishal, can you talk about this work?
Sure. Priya Geetha's work sits within a larger kind of contextual research project that she's kind of looking at the histories of rubber plantations in Malaya, present-day Malaysia and Singapore, and kind of drawing from this point of departure after indentured servants and indentured people from South Asia were taken to these plantations to work as essentially as bonded labor, which Priya Geetha talks about in the colonial Kangani system, which existed as a kind of replacement to slavery, but without calling it that, colonial powers were able to kind of get away with the fact that they were also proclaiming that they had abolished slavery while continuing the practices and continuing the extraction of rubber and other plantations in Southeast Asia. Within the work itself and within across her practice as well, Priya Geetha uses a range of materials, in this case CGI, computer generated imagery, and working with the game engine to design this environment of a rubber plantation. And within the work, she's kind of thinking about that colonial Kangani system and the exploitation of South Indian laborers under that system and their working conditions, the formation of new identities within the dynamics of the plantation, particularly the power dynamics that are being replicated in the plantation. And she's integrating the concept of the third space to present the rubber plantation as a complex evolving site of economic production, social stratification, and sort of cultural hybridity. The sounds in the work are especially sort of specific to a cultural practice that Priya Geetha is also drawing from, in which you kind of hear these sounds at the background that come from a practice called Oppari. Oppari is lament music in Tamil culture, particularly practiced by Dalit, Bahujan and Adivasi communities in Tamil Nadu. In the case of the work, this kind of lament practice is reimagined through H-E-A-T as a speculative entity It's called Havia Exhaust Automation Tech, and it's a technological kind of entity that's not entirely apparent on the screen, but is present within the context of the work. And it is the entity that is performing Oppari as an act of mourning and resistance. And the integration of a kind of speculative future or a speculative version of those very present, very real dynamics of existing within the plantation draws to larger kind of the research-based practice of Priyagita, in which he's looking at the broader connotations of the concept of the plantation scene as a time in which plantations effectively produced a different timeline to the reality around them. In the works, he's also trying to think about what is the way to provide a critique of colonial exploitation and what are the kind of mechanisms that can be provided as a speculative meditation on the potential of technology to empathize and memorialize kind of non-human entities. The act of singing, the act of Oppari itself, while it's performed by humans, in its kind of absorption into a kind of techno-future, what is the kind of possibility and what is the imagination that we're actually trying to think about, and how does the space here within Artsaz and within the space of the exhibition offer that for audiences? It's also worth to kind of mention that, you know, the work itself has a lot of flashing lights. It has brightly colored bits of white and orange, as well as percussions that also come from different instruments, particularly the parai in Tamil Nadu, which is an instrument performed nearly only by Dalit communities in Tamil Nadu. And the space is also kind of lit in this dim reddish-orange glow, which mimics the fire of a plantation, the fire when a plantation kind of catches fire, the kind of color that it produces, which is referenced in the video as well, but is also spilling over into the space through the kind of color of light that we've created here.
Excellent. Thanks, Vishal. I will also say, like, in a very practical sense, to experience the work within the space, there is a white bench that people can sit on, but there's also lots of space to stand and spend time in here with this work. We're moving back into the middle section, and opposite the entrance is a striking altar called This Is a Protest, and this work is by Tabitha Percy. It's a tall and narrow, intimate space enclosed in off-white fabric, hung from the ceiling, cascading orange marigolds that are fringing the space above. And below, a solitary white plinth with a single Hessian-covered A5-sized handmade photo book with the title on the front cover, and features pages and pages of photos and text. The front page has the words, "This is a protest," printed in white multiple times down the page. And there is a photo of people cutting a cake on the front.
It's the artist's birthday party.
It's the artist's birthday party. Beautiful. And I'm going to just randomly open to another page. It's a blurry, out-of-focus photo that looks like it's a natural outside space. There are tree leaves at the top. And the text inside says, "The final assault." And then came the final assault on the Dalits on the morning of August 6th. The ghastly incident was pre-planned and well executed by the upper castes with the clear connivance of the police officials present in the village. The complicity of the police is obvious from the fact that the carnage took place when prohibitory orders were in force and the whole village was tense for the past 1 month. So this book is an auto-ethnographic rewriting of a deliberately initialised caste-based violence in Andhra Pradesh. These are stories of survival presented from the community's perspectives and memories of the incident. What could you tell us about this work?
The work itself is a kind of an expansion of the book. The book is titled This Is a Protest, which is thinking through the process of recreating from memory a truly terrible incident that happened in Chunduru in Andhra Pradesh in the early 90s, which is a horrific act of caste violence where the dominant upper caste Reddys kind of nearly tried to wipe out the population of Dalits in the village. It was a kind of very large incident with great political and social ramifications that kind of threatened to really destroy the peace of the state of Andhra Pradesh at the time. And the very rapid kind of clamping down of freedoms and evacuation and displacement of Dalits from Chanduru into other parts of the state are a very dark period in the history of India, as well as in the history of like inter-caste unity, inter-caste kind of living in the state of Andhra Pradesh. The fact that the incident kind of opened up the realities and presented with honesty that the myth of inter-caste co-living actually did not exist and the hierarchies were ever present, that really resulted in a kind of act of spectacular violence. The installation is essentially a grief altar. It is an altar that is heightening the experience of engaging and reading with the book. The book in itself doesn't depict any images of the violence in images, but does speak about it in words. And they are words drawn from news reports, recollections by family members and other members of the community. Tabitha Percy, the artist, is herself a descendant of survivors of the violence, her parents being some of them. And she's kind of trying to think about what is the process of creating a book like this in trying to reclaim personal archive, but also in the process of reclaiming that personal archive is also creating an archive for the community. And the book essentially kind of challenges the abjection of Dalit life experiences, grief, and the kind of definitions of modernity that kind of surround contemporary Dalit identity. The book also kind of tries to highlight the importance of asserting Dalit identity and what is the space to process and grieve the loss of Dalit life. While the contents of the book go deeper into the account of growing up in a segregated part of Modukuru and the social tensions of between the Dalits and the Reddys being the kind of oppressor caste community that also conducted a lot of the violence, the altar itself is kind of referencing broader Dalit cultural practices of grieving in the public space. We're kind of looking at the ways that Dalit communities have always negotiated and navigated access to this public space, as caste rules also dictate how Dalit bodies move through what is otherwise understood as commonly accessible public space, but is still very much practiced in restrictive ways to control the movement and the flow and the presence of Dalit bodies in these common public spaces. So the kind of act of mourning in the public view is not only a continuation of varying Dalit lamentation and grieving practices, some of which we kind of see in Priya's work with Oppari, and also some of which in the process of singing about the death of ancestors in Poikail and Sajan's work. In Percy's work, we're thinking about a more recent time, a time just from 20-something years ago, which continues the tradition of reclaiming this public space and asserting that we too belong to the publics that the space is meant to serve. So in the work essentially here in the altar, Percy's kind of inviting audiences to come through, touch the book. The book itself is enclosed in material what we colloquially call a gunny bag or a jute sack. It's made of jute and it's a very tactile object. It's made to be touched and to be interacted with. And through that, she's also drawing a connection to several of the other artists across Nirikshane and Olalala are doing, in which there is an invitation that is explicitly about touch. And in accepting that invitation, audiences are also kind of joining a kind of act of protest, an act of resistance of saying that untouchability is no longer a valid practice. It never was. But in inviting audiences to kind of join in, artists are kind of providing the space to say, this is a non-hierarchical space and this is kind of how we're making these gestures towards audiences we don't know, but are very much inviting them to come and interact with our works.
Thank you. Okay, we're now going to turn to our right. And we have across the dividing wall the video works, Not So White and Seemingly Innocent by Jagath Dihira Sekera. Each is an 8-channel video work which are displayed across 8 LCD screens that are mounted across the wall. The screens rotate from portrait orientation to landscape orientation every 8 minutes, and you'll be able to hear them when they turn. Not So White is displayed in portrait and Seemingly Innocent in landscape. I'm going to talk about Seemingly Innocent because that's what the screens are showing at the moment. So it features a single person standing outside in front of various public and private dwellings and buildings in various locations. So outside a house, outside a shop that's called Tropical Paradise, outside a sports venue seating are some of the spaces, and floating across the person in place are brightly coloured objects such as an iron, barbed wire, a pair of work boots and pliers. Can you talk about this particular work, Vishal?
Sure. Jagat Dhirasekara is an artist based in Sydney who for many years spent living in exile as an activist from Sri Lanka, lived both in self-exile but also given the political kind of conditions of the state of Sri Lanka, made it difficult for him to return as somebody who had been an activist resisting the regime. In Seemingly Innocent, Jagat is kind of drawing from his own experiences as being detained and as having undergone a range of kind of experience as a detainee. But across the 8 videos, Jagat is kind of photographing himself standing in front of a lot of these centers of detention, which were also called torture chambers across Sri Lanka. In it, Jagat is kind of drawing from the long history in resisting the regime in Sri Lanka, particularly in this work, the period between 1987 to 1990, and the rebellion that was led by the People's Liberation Front. And Jagat is going back and revisiting these sites several years later and kind of photographing himself in front of these sites, some of which are the sites that he himself was imprisoned in. And on top of it, you kind of see this series of collaged objects in different colors that appear every now and then. The objects are hardcover books, boots, pliers, irons, steel irons for pressing clothes, as well as battery clips, barbed wire, pencils, and plastic bags. These were the tools of torture that were used. There were some of the tools of torture that were used by the regime to interrogate and inflict pain upon people that they suspected of having carried out different acts or people who were unagreeable to the regime, so to speak. The work in itself across 8 channels is kind of talking very specifically to that time period, but also connects to the larger histories of political struggle in Sri Lanka. And as it kind of changes orientation, we come into the other work, which is Not So White, Regained Territories.